instead of trying to make your life perfect, give yourself the freedom to make it an adventure and go ever upward. Drew Houston.
We eventually get up there. I'm really worn out, and the sun caught us. So now it's dark. The clouds come in. Temperature drops. The hiking guide is now like, all right, let's try to wait this out because it starts even sprinkling on us. So we start cuddling pretty much, you know, next to this rock, just hiding down because the wind is coming across. You know, you're thousands and thousands of feet up. So it's like it's coming in. It's freezing. I didn't bring gloves. I didn't bring anything because we had just dropped all our stuff off at the base camp. And I didn't put it all together. So I had nothing on this hike.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the Trail Dirtbags and Hiker Trash. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just keep that to yourself. This week, I'm talking to world traveler, author, blogger, and adventurer, Joshua Bigger. And actually, I just learned in our pre-interview talk here that I'm also talking to a world record holder and a doctor as well. So welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, Joshua. How's it going?
It's going pretty good. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Now, in America, there is this unique tradition of assigning trail names to people that have been out on the trail based on, you know, something in their past, some peculiarity that, or some action that happens on the trail. In all of your world travels, have you managed to pick up a trail name?
No, I really haven't picked up a trail name. But if they were going to do a trail name, it'd have to be Bigger's World. Because it just surrounds me with everything nowadays.
That's right. Bigger's World. So what if we just go with Bigger's for the sake of this podcast? Because we could usually go by trail names.
Yeah, that works for me.
Bigger's. Is that a common way that you are referenced in real life?
It is, because after being I'm retired from the Army. So after being, you know, military retired, we always go by last names no matter what.
Okay. And it's Bigger's with an S.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Hey, have you had a chance to listen to the podcast before, Bigger's?
I actually hadn't listened to it before me and you got connected. And then I started listening to clips here and there. And I love watching and like listening to people's takes from all over the world and doing different hiking, because there's so many different levels of hiker. You know, I'm probably one of the lower levels of hiker when it comes to it. But then hearing, you know, my views on a certain hike and then, you know, someone that's a 10 on the hiker view, it's really crazy to like really listen to all that. I love it.
Okay. So you brought up the ranking system right there. Someone who's a 10, if we were to rank you in terms of hiking, professional hiking knowledge on a scale of 1 to 10, where does Bigger's fall?
Ooh, probably an unbelievably, incredible 4.5. I mean, a solid 4.5.
Solid 4.5. Love it. Love it. Hey, I only ask if you would listen because I want to make sure you're aware of a segment towards the end of the episode called the Pro Tip Insight of the Week. And that's where I will turn to you and ask you to share some trail wisdom or travel wisdom with our listeners to make their next trip even better. So don't be surprised when we get there.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
The must bring gear review.
Oh, hey, that was my youngest daughter there, Half Calf, helping me out with segment introductions. It's the must bring gear review. So that's another feature we've been doing recently. And this is sponsored by the ultralight backpacking gear company, Six Moon Designs. And so here's how it works, Biggers. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for either a multi-day hike or for a trip to one of the far reaches of the world, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So Biggers, what's your must bring piece of gear?
Well, I'm glad that you really specified that, because at first I was about to go peanut M&Ms, but I'm glad that we got it.
That's a solid choice. That's a solid choice, by the way.
You know, a lot of times when you're hiking, it's just something that takes your mind off the pain sometimes, for sure. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going to go at a must pack, I mean, it's boots. It's the right boots. And I'm a Merrell guy. Always have been, you know, through the Army and after the Army, just, you got to have a great pair of boots on your feet, or there's very little that's worse in the pain department than your feet at the end of a bad hike, you know, a good hike or a bad hike, either way.
That's right. That's right. I mean, if the feet are hurting, you're not enjoying the hike. You can't concentrate on anything but the next step of pain you're going to take.
100%.
Yeah. Now, are there a lot of parallels between military service and hiking? I mean, you guys do the physical work out there.
You know, there is, and you know, there's this one competition that always brings back memories. It's called the German Armed Forces competition, and it involves a 20-mile hike at the end. And it's, you know, it was probably the beginning of my, you know, my hiking journey competing in that competition. And that's also the first time I found out what hiking blisters were when I got down to the end and everything. And that's kind of the reason I always bring up the, you know, the perfect boots, because when that happened, it was young in my military career. And it was an amazing thing, because the 20-mile hike is at the very end. And it's like, once you complete it, then you get the big gold eagle and you just feel so proud. But man, there's been multiple people, and you can even look it up on like on YouTube channels and stuff. Like, if you just look up German Armed Forces badge, you can see some of the people just falling across the finish line. Because I mean, a 20-mile hike for an avid hiker, that's nothing really. But for a regular person, 20 miles is a lifetime.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. As the long trail through hikers, you know, doing the PCT or the AT or the Continental Divide Trail, you know, they may start out with 20 mile days, but by the time they're finished, they're logging, you know, 30, 35, 40 plus mile days. Like it's nobody's business. Now, I imagine that in the Army, everything is issued, all your equipment, all your clothing, everything is issued by the government, by the Army, correct?
Yes.
Including your boots.
They are, but I would say it's become a lot different over the years, but once you get issued boots, but you can go out and buy better boots. And that's kind of how I got introduced to Merrell, because they had I don't know if it was Merrell or a subsidiary company that made some really good boots, and they had great zippers on the bottom, and they were amazing hiking boots. And I still use them to this day. I actually just threw out a pair like last week, because I've had them for 10 years and I need a new pair now. But yeah, you can get some really good hiking boots that also will work in your uniform as well.
Okay, because I was just thinking, you know, you mentioned foot pain and just having to deal with some kind of general issue boot that everybody else was wearing, you know, didn't sound too attractive.
Oh yeah. And like basic training, AIT, and you're like your OSET training. No, you are in the issued U.S. Army boot as you're doing all the hiking, and there is nothing you could do. And the worst part about it is, you know, the boots are only made one way, but you know, some people have arches, some people don't, some people are flat footed, and it doesn't matter, because when you go in, sorry, that's part of the rules. Everyone's got to have the exact same attire, so everyone has the exact same amount, you know, a chance of succeeding in basic and AIT training.
Right. I mean, if you go on to hiker social media, whatever that looks like, a lot of the discussion focuses on footwear. So you talk about people having different feet and different preferences. That is a very real thing. And there's a lot of discussion about, you know, what you should put on your foot and where you should look. So having that single one size fits all, that sounds not like a whole lot of fun. So.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it kind of does. It's the Army way. In the beginning, everyone is the same. You know, that's the whole point of it. When you're going through basic training, they want to simplify the process and make everyone as equal as possible when you're going through things. So then if you can, and you know, your feet are just like anything else. They will evolve. They will adjust as, you know, you get better and stronger with it. But I'll tell you what, I would definitely always prefer a nice pair of Merrell hiking boots over a military issue boots any day.
All right. Hey, let's keep talking about gear.
It's the hiking poll.
With this 7-question survey I'm going to ask you, this is a questionnaire that's going to help me determine what level of crazy you are from a scale of 1 to 100. with actually 100 being completely sane and number one being completely bonkers. And again, we can adjust this to apply to any of the hiking that you've done or how you would apply it to hiking, or you could also kind of apply it to kind of your world adventures and traveling. So feel free to go in any direction you want on these. First question is trekking poles when you're out there hiking. Yes or no?
No.
No. And why do you say that?
I don't know. I just, you know, I've never been a trekking pole person. I don't know if it was, you know, I was introduced to it with my grandfather. I remember he took me on my first hike when I was like, you know, maybe 8 or 9, and he would always have like 2 of them. And I don't know if I associated that with the elderly, and I'm like, I'll never have a trekking pole. And I don't know if that just got in my mind or something, but I've just never really used one. And anytime someone's given me one, you know, I generally just play with it in my hands, you know, like just twirling it around and stuff rather than actually using it for what it is. And I mean, that could be the reason I'm always in pain after hikes. This could be opening my eyes to things.
You know, Dr. Biggers, you know what I really enjoyed about that answer is I asked you the question and it was just a very definitive no. <Mm-mm>. That was great. Okay. Next question. Boots or trail runners?
Boots.
And you've mentioned the Merrells. So
yeah, definitely the Merrells. And I think it's also because, and I could be, you know, there might be trail runners that go along, but I like my boots to be a little higher on my leg. I prefer some that are well over the ankle, if not even, you know, closer to my shin, if not halfway up my shin. That could also be a military thing. You know, all the military boots, that's the way they're built. And maybe that's just, you know, I had to wear those for, you know, decades and decades, many, many years. So, but yeah, I kind of prefer a boot that goes pretty far up my leg.
Okay. So mid shin, maybe not thigh high boots.
Yeah, not thigh high.
No. Okay. All right. Just clarify. All right. Now preferred sleep system. You can even apply your military experience to this. So not sleep system, shelter system, preferred shelter system, tent, tarp, hammock, bivy or cowboy camping?
Probably gonna go tent, actually. You know, just I get it. You know, tents take up more room than probably the tarp or even the hammock. You can make it, you know, I'm super small nowadays. But I've never been a hammock sleeper either, though. I can sleep on the ground flat very, very well, but I can't sleep in a hammock. And the people that can do it, that's amazing for them. It's kind of like people that can, you know, sleep on buses and airplanes. That ain't happening for me. But if hammocks, you can, that's amazing.
Hammocks, I could take a fantastic nap in a hammock. If I have to sleep overnight in a hammock, not going to happen.
Oh, I learned that one the hard way. We'll get to it later, but I just thought of another big hike in Havasu Falls in Arizona. When we did that one, we only brought hammocks because my buddy's like, don't worry, dude. I'll help you. You'll be able to sleep in the hammock. Worst sleep ever. Miserable.
All right. Next question. Sleeping bag or quilt?
Sleeping bag.
Traditionalist.
Yeah. Well, also military. You're issued one doing AIT. So I've had a sleeping bag since I was 17 years old. And okay. Just forever.
And for our listeners and for the host, AIT stands for?
It's the training you go to after basic. So AIT is all about like your advanced training. So whatever your job is going to be, then you go through it. So, you know, hypothetically say you're going to be a trash man in the military, you got to go to trash school. Say you're going to be an accountant, you got to go to accountant school, just whatever your schooling is afterwards.
Makes sense. Okay. This question, very important, Dr. Biggers, huge point deduction if you answered incorrectly. You ready?
Okay. All right.
When it comes to food, stove, cold soak or stoveless? And if you need help with defining any of those terms, just let me know.
Well, I'm going to go stoveless right off the bat because I'm an MRE guy. All the long hikes I've done, and again, this goes back to military, MREs are where it's at, man. I don't need no stove. I don't need nothing. You give me a good old-fashioned MRE, and it's funny how many people hate them. I know a lot of people I've met, they can't stand them. I love them. I have bought them before. I'm not kidding you. I've actually done first dates where I told a girl I was going to cook for her and we ate MREs. She didn't like it that much, but she thought the thought was really, really funny because I find them actually pretty delicious. I don't know why.
Now, Biggers, was there a second date after that?
Yeah, no, there was a couple more dates. Okay. Actually, did cook for eventually, but it's like, you know, I thought it was funny. And, but you know, yeah, it's kind of just, it's a thing where I don't know if it's, you know, they just get a bad rap or whatnot, but I've had a lot of really good ones too. There is that one you never want. I remember the horror stories in the military, and it's the eggs. You never want to get the egg one. You never want to see the eggs because, man, those are horrible. But everything else is that's all right.
So is it a surprise? I mean, are they unlabeled? It just, you know, no. MRE, and you open it up and it's like, hey, surprise, this is what we're eating today.
It's labeled whatever the entree is. So if it's like chili mac, it says chili mac on it. But then once you've done them enough and you've eaten enough, like there's one that's called that. I like the chili one because the chili one comes with a huge pack of jalapeno cheese. It comes with regular M&Ms, and it just comes with like stuff that I enjoy. And not to mention when you pack them the right way. And this goes back into, it's funny, we're talking about MREs. When I did Burning, I've done Burning Man a few times, and I've taken MREs to Burning Man because I enjoy them. But, you know, I would say I'm definitely the minority in that group. I don't think there's a lot of people that are going to watch this and be like, yeah, MRE power. I don't think they're going to be doing that.
You know, I interviewed a guest who her boyfriend wanted to get going on hiking, backpacking, and they didn't do a whole lot of research. And when it came to food, she went and she tried to find MREs because I think that was maybe in her background as well. And she couldn't find them anywhere, trying to buy them in bulk. And, you know, if you load up 10 MREs, I mean, how much does an MRE weigh?
I mean, it's probably, you know, I would say at least 10 ounces, 16 ounces. I mean, I don't think it's super, super light.
Yeah.
By any means, but that's kind of the only issue would be loading up. I think MREs would be very good for a 3-day hike or a 4-day hike because also an MRE is built to where it has all the food and nutrition you need for the entire day. Mm-hmm. So you could eat this breakfast, lunch, and dinner, the same MRE in theory. Like obviously a lot of people would, you know, could overindulge there, but, and that's kind of what makes it difficult. But I can find them on eBay a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, eBay is where I usually go if I need some.
And MRE, do you know what the initials stand for?
Oh, absolutely not. Not even close. Not even close. But I'm thinking maybe military recreational expenditure. Something like that.
I will put it in the show notes after we're done here. So we'll put that, we'll spell that out. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, this next question, life is better above or below the tree line?
Whew. Finally, we got one that can kind of, that's a tough one there. Cause I mean, the first thing I'm thinking about is safety wise. And if I'm thinking safety wise, I'm going above the tree line all day long. But, you know, beauty wise, I would say it's probably beneath the tree line because I mean, I love animals and seeing all that stuff. But if I had to choose, I'd go above the tree line for pretty much everything because you can see things coming. That's one of the big things with me and hiking and camping. I'm always kind of, and this could be the military watch eye or whatnot, but, right. You know, I'm always trying to watch my surroundings, always observing on this. Not to mention some of the places like in Brazil when we were down there and snakes are everywhere. And that goes into why I like those boots that we were talking about earlier. I have a huge, like even when I mow my lawn and like I weed eat some of my acres, I have these shin guard things that go completely around my leg to watch me because I do not want to get bit by a snake. Like that is, that's a tough one for me.
That's when those thigh high boots would come in handy.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, right.
Yeah, that and, you know, any neighbors that drove by would be like, oh, look at that guy, the thigh high boots going on over here.
Now you said that the beauty is below the tree line, but you know, hey, look at my background here.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
That's all above the tree line. That's above 10,000 feet. That's in the Sierras. Man, I love the beauty above the tree line as well.
Really? Yeah, I think when I look at beauty though, it's like because I was actually thinking of that when you're any type of skylines as well is just gonna be gorgeous. But I feel like it's just like animal, like a lot of times I associate the beauty of like nature with animals and seeing animals.
Unless it's a snake.
And this is a snake, man. The snakes are the only one because they're just so, they're ninjas. They're ninjas. They just come out of nowhere.
Yeah, we're in their environment, right? So
absolutely.
Yep. All right. Last question. What's more important, pack weight or luxury items?
Oh, pack weight. Yeah, I'm not trying to. When I talk about me at the 4.5 at the hiker there, it goes more. That's just more about simplicity for me. Like if someone, I've went on hikes before where someone's like, hey, we're going on a hike tomorrow. And I'll get one of those little string backpacks. The last time I did Acatenango, the hike we'll get into later. I've done it twice. And the time I just did it last year, I did it with a string backpack. Nothing else, just a string backpack. And people were looking at me like I was a crazy person. But I had good shoes and I had my M&Ms. I didn't need anything else. That was it. That's it.
Couple things. Number one, you've said Acatenango a couple of times before the interview and now once in the interview. That's just a really fun word to say, right?
It is. It is.
It kind of rolls off the tongue.
Well, and then when you go into all of them, just Pacaya, Acatenango, Fuego, they're all like just awesome names in hikes in Guatemala. And it's just like, they definitely, whoever named those, I give them that thumbs up right there. That's 100% thumbs up.
Nice. And second, I one of my favorite guests on the podcast who's been on multiple times is Ben Vaughn. He's ex-military. He finished his service as a lieutenant commander in the Navy. And he got it in his mind that he wanted to do the Appalachian Trail. Somebody gave him a book 10 years prior to his retirement and it got him hooked. And so for 10 years, he stewed on the wanting to do this 2,200 mile hike along the East Coast. And so when he retired, he said he sold everything, got rid of everything. He put together a pack and being ex-military, he was prepared. He had three of everything in case the first two went bad. Right. So he had like a 60-pound pack. He shows up down there to Springer Mountain with a 60-pound pack. This is his first long trail. He's since gone on to hike all three of the long trails and become a triple crowner. But he met up with a guy named Scrapbook, who was 21 years old at the time. And unbeknownst to Gingerballs, which was Ben's trail name eventually, unbeknownst to Gingerballs, Scrapbook, this was his third long trail. He'd already done the PCT and the CDT, and he knew what he was doing. And his pack was about 13 pounds. And the two of them, this is the funniest image in my mind. The two of them meet for the first time at Springer Mountain. They eventually become great friends, but they are each looking at each other thinking, oh, this guy's never going to make it. Ben's looking at Scrapbook and he's got this little puny pack on. He's like, oh, this guy's not going to survive out there. And Scrapbook, the youngster with all the trail knowledge and wisdom, is looking at Ben going, oh my gosh, a 60-pound pack. This guy is going to die out there. So really, really funny.
Without a doubt. And, you know, I guarantee you when we started that hike in last year, no one really knew that I'd already done it. So they all had their full hiking gear. I'm talking, you know, 30, 40 pounds on their back. And I had maybe three. So I'm sure they were looking at me like, who is this guy? And that's different for some people, too. Like, you know, after you do enough hikes, eventually you realize that we always, even when I travel, I always pack more than I need, always. And you only need so much, especially on a weekend hike. A weekend hike, you could survive naked for 48 hours if you had to. It's only a weekend hike. And I think that's the difference with the guy, Gingerballs, like you're talking about. He was going for 2,200 miles. Like, this is a little different hike. And it is kind of crazy that you said the Scrapyard guy, like 13, man. That's light for such a big hike, but he obviously knew what he was doing for sure.
Yeah. Yep. All right. I've got a score for you. I got to do a little bit complicated math here to arrive at your craziness scale. So we're going to carry the 4, going to multiply by the square root of 2, divide that by pi, and it's a solid 73. So bye. Congratulations, Dr. Biggers. That's not too outrageous in either direction. And you know, it kind of coincides with your solid 4.5 that you gave yourself earlier. Yeah,
it does. You know, I think it's a solid score. It's, you know, it's that score where, you know, you could tell your friend if you're about to hike, you know, 28 miles, don't ask me. But if you're about to hike 6, yeah, bring me along. I'm in. For sure. I get it.
It's all about the context. 100%. Okay. Hey, before we get too far down the trail, really want to hear about your origin story, kind of where you grew up, your background, kind of sports and hobbies. Tell us a little bit about your military service, where you served, and how you got involved in maybe not the thru-hiking cult, but the world traveling cult. I mean, you kind of gave it all up and took the leap and have just been going all around the world recently. So let's hear about your background.
So we'll do a shortened version, and we'd be here for about 14 hours. I started off a traveler when I was born. I was born in Bermuda.
We're going way back.
So just real quick, my father did.
No, it's okay. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
my dad, he did a tour in Antarctica in the Navy. And afterwards, he got to choose anywhere in the world he wanted to live. And he chose Bermuda. So I was blessed enough to, you know, be born on a beautiful island and kind of being born abroad. And then fast forward a bunch, you know, then we lived in California for a while and then Florida. And then I joined the military right out of high school. I still remember skipping algebra class to take the ASVAB test to go into the military. And I didn't even want to go into the military. I just didn't want to take the exam I had in algebra.
Now, no one behold. Did you go to school in California?
No, Florida.
Florida. Okay.
Yeah. California was more for like elementary, middle school. And then we ended up going over to Florida. And I was walking down the hall and the recruiter could see that I didn't want to go to class. He's like, hey, I can get you out the whole day. And I'm like, what? And he's like, and I'll give you pizza. I'm like, I'm in. I'm done. It's good.
You said, so, sign me up. You said, sign me up. And that's what happened.
Yep. Took the ASVAB test, scored rather well. And then when they start offering you things and throwing money your way. And before you know it, U.S. Army, here I come. So then I joined the Army, was in there almost 11 years. Then we did a couple tours in Afghanistan, Kuwait, and Kyrgyzstan. And then a couple tours up at the Pentagon as well. And then I got hurt on my last one. So I was medically retired afterwards. And, you know, it hurt because, you know, no one wants to be retired out because I thought I was in the military the rest of my life. But then it ended up opening up so many other things. So then I was able to get my bachelor's and my MBA and then move on to my doctorate afterwards. And I may have never been able to do that if I wasn't retired from the military. And then also after I got retired from the military, you know, you are kind of, when you've been doing the same thing for a decade, you kind of get a little lost. So then I just bought a one-way ticket to Bangkok, Thailand, like everybody on your first trip. And boom, that started. And then one thing led to another and the next thing. And then 5 years later, I've been over 130 plus countries in all 50 states and going with it from there.
Okay. And you just recently got your doctorate. I mean, it's fairly fresh, right?
Yeah. About 5 months, 4 or 5 months ago. And I was writing my doctorate the whole time I was traveling as well, or my doctoral dissertation. And it was, you know, and that's one thing I always love to talk to people about because, you know, especially Americans, a lot of Americans, they think so much goes into traveling. They don't think they can do it and stuff like that. But I mean, and I'm not saying there aren't your exceptions, but, you know, I was going full time to school, running a business and traveling. You can do it. You can. But it takes that one big decision of, all right, I'm going. And I was more scared than ever when I was probably more scared getting on that one-way ticket to Bangkok than I was my first tour in Afghanistan.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's just like, because you have nothing once you sell everything and you take that leap, you know. And also when you're going to Afghanistan, you got all your boys and your everyone behind you, everyone that's in your unit. Mm-hmm. When you buy that one-way ticket, it's just you in a country that you don't know the language and you don't know the people, you don't know the customs. So it was definitely a trial and error process for the next few years, for sure.
Right. And what is your doctorate in?
Sociological human behavior. So okay.
You're a student of people then.
Yeah, and it kind of worked out really well, to be honest, because my dissertation was written on combat veterans transitioning back into the civilian workplace. So studying and interviewing so many, it really was really cool to, you know, it was something that I'm truly passionate about. And then also something that just gives me even more, you know, it allows me to give back to the community that I love so much, both traveling and veterans.
Right. Now that's interesting because I know I've talked to a lot of folks who have done a fair amount of hiking and they've come out of military service. And a lot of times there are folks out there who are working on things because when you're out there hiking, you know, even if you're with a group of people, not everybody hikes at the same speed. So you're spending a lot of time by yourself and inside your own head and kind of sorting stuff out. And, you know, that applies to, you know, veterans as well as other people who have things in their life that they want to focus on and kind of work through. Do you think travel took that same kind of approach for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It did. And, you know, it also makes you really begin to trust yourself and your own instincts when you're traveling, because when it comes down to it, you're the only one there. Yeah, you know, and I have met amazing people all over the world, you know, that came to, you know, I've had issues where, I needed to get somewhere and I could not speak the language. And then I use body language. Before I know it, I meet some amazing people and they can't speak my language. I can't speak theirs, but we end up finding me a way to get to wherever I need. And it's phenomenal. But that all comes from, you know, learning to trust yourself.
I would love to watch those interactions, just trying to communicate back and forth with each other non-verbally to get from point A to point B. That had to be fun.
And, you know, body language is the true, universal language, mm-hmm. without a doubt.
Yep. All right. Hey, Biggers, what are you doing to pay the bills? How do you finance your trips?
I'm a professor currently, and I do it remotely. So being a remote professor is amazing. So at least going through all those years of school, you know, once you went through school for 10, 12 years, you're like, man, I hope this pays off. So at least that does help pay off. But also when I was traveling, I started my website and I started a few different websites that, you know, people go to get their information and stuff like that. And I also have a really good email program where I can, I send out hundreds and hundreds of emails to different hotels and hostels and Airbnbs. And once you learn how to market with a lot of the individuals that work on those things, your stays can all be free. And, it was trial and error after a while, but traveling abroad, I mean, I have like records that show that I was living off of, you know, $4 and $5 US a day. And I wasn't living in the gutters. I was living just fine, but you learn the bartering system is a real system today. And I think a lot of people forget about that, you know, everyone, I went to, when I was in Guatemala for a little bit, I was working with a family and I would do work on their house and I would help, build them. I helped them build a website and then they cooked me food for a full month. Like there's always ways to get around it. And I understand some people listening to this podcast, that might not be their way because I mean, that is a different way. That's a different way of traveling for sure. But there's always a way to travel. Always. And if you learn the system and you can get to it very, very cheaply.
Okay. Fantastic. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back though, we're going to talk about some of those adventures, some of that travel. And I definitely want to get to the world records. I can't wait to hear about those. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back. From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. with the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it. Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young. And welcome back. We are talking to Biggers, although I feel obligated to call him Dr. Biggers because of his recent accomplishments and my respect for that title. We heard about your a little bit about your military service and growing up and went through a couple of the early segments, but I am really intrigued by this nugget that you dropped at the very, I think it was before the interview even started in our pre-interview discussion about five world records. And so what's going on there? I have to hear about these world records.
Well, you know, so the pandemic stopped a lot of us in our tracks, especially a lot of the travelers and whatnot. And when it happened, you know, I got stuck. First, I was in Iceland, got stuck. I got out of there. And then I got stuck in Florida for a little bit and then North Carolina. And we just couldn't do a lot of traveling. But I'm one of those types where if I'm not doing something nonstop, I get real stir crazy. And so then I decided to start writing a few books. And that led me to applying for some Guinness World Records. And when it started, I was just, you know, I'm like everybody else, you know, when you see that, you know, that certificate, you want one of those for your wall, you know, you just want one of those. And I was like, all right. But then the process is very daunting. You know, it's a very like, you know, scary process because you have to have a certain amount of people there. You have to have, you know, video recordings from all different directions. You got to have witnesses and stuff like that. And it scares a lot of people off. Well, I decided, you know what, I'm getting one. So the first one I applied for was the longest cornhole shot. And I was like, you know what? I'm pretty good at cornhole. I can do this. I think I can do this. And I had some people in Florida. Cornhole was exploding in 2020. Like, you know, I feel like cornhole, pickleball, and disc golf just exploded over this pandemic, those sports. So I was like, you know what? I need to get in these sports early and get me some Guinness World Records. Well, crazy enough, the record was like 50 feet or something like that, you know? And I was like, you know, I can do a 50 foot shot. I'm sure I've done it before, but the shot is not the hard part. That's what a lot of people trying to get Guinness World Records get confused about. It's all of that stuff you have to do to get the Guinness World Record to sign off on your attempt. You know, like, yeah, there's plenty of people out there that can make the shot, but can you do A, B, C, 1, 2, 3 to get that chance? So eventually I got it all set up and I went out and I was going to go for, give a shout out to John Pertile with the St. Petersburg Cornhole. He helped me with that one. And I was going after longest cornhole shot and longest cornhole shot blindfolded. Cause I was like, I'm already doing it. Let me put a blindfold on and see what happens. So we get everything set up. I got the sponsors there. I got the referees there. I got the, I had to have a guy come out and make sure everything was level and all that stuff. And, so I start practicing and I'm like, you know, I'm already getting nervous because there's a tournament going on at the same time. And I'm just sitting over here all by myself while this tournament's happening. And I'm like, oh man, everyone's like looking over. Well, 8 shots in and I sink it and I get the record there. And then I'm getting ready for the blindfolded one. I'm like, I'm just going to go for it. Take a couple practice shots, get the blindfold on. I have to have someone come over, you know, make sure it's all good to go. I go up for the shot. Everyone gets quiet all of a sudden. And I'm like, what just happened? First shot, Guinness World Record, blindfolded, done. and it was just so funny because you go through, I was practicing for hours a day, you know, before this, because I want to do it. And then when it all comes down to it, I got the 2 Guinness World Records in 9 shots. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding. But that's what happens. You know, practice makes perfect after a while. And, since then, both those initial records have been broken, but not by a lot. And I have it planned for May to go and break those again, because, you know, then I get 2 more of those certificates. Now, you know, that's what it's all about. But at that same time, I then wanted to get some disc golf ones because disc golf was exploding. And I noticed this one's one of the funniest ones is that. So I go for the disc golf, the longest disc golf ace, which means, you know, throwing a disc straight into the basket, the longest. And there hadn't been one yet. Cause remember, disc golf was just now exploding. So I'm like, all right, So when you're going to set a record that's never been set, the process is a little more extensive. But I end up getting going through it all, and I go out and I get it, and I break it at like I set it at 101 feet, not very far at all. The funny thing is, 5 days later, that same record is broken by a guy who's a pro disc golfer at 550 feet, and I am never breaking that one. That one is gone. But because I was the one who set it, I still got my certificate. So, you know, I still, at one moment, I was the longest disc golf ace.
Get to hold on to that for a few days.
Yeah, exactly. I only had that one for 5 days. And then at that same time, I did the longest or the fastest round of disc golf. So I played 18 holes and just over 14 minutes. That one was super, super exhausting. And I had to have two people follow me, running behind me. And they had to like monitor it as I was going through, because you have to play the full hole. You have to put it in the basket, make sure it settles, come out. That one was probably the most exhausting. But the fifth and final one, I'm mostly proud of. This is my pride of joy. And my dad always laughs at me because I have it sitting right next to my doctorate. So, you know, I put, and he always laughs at me because he always asks me, like, you know, which one are you more proud of?
Right.
And I'm like, you know, several people have doctorates. Not a lot of people have this Guinness World Record. And the reason is because this Guinness World Record is for the most donuts stacked in 1 minute blindfolded. And it was the hardest record of all of them to do. This record, I'm telling you, I probably have 9 hours of camera footage trying to get this record, because it was only 9 donuts, but people don't realize all the stuff before that. These donuts have to be made specifically for the thing. So you have to show the making process. They have to be two and three quarter inches. So just under 3 inches. So now stack up 3 inches times 9, you're looking at 27 inches. That is a high thing. And then once you get it up to it, it has to sit still for 5 seconds before it falls over. And mine sat still for 5.2 seconds, like down to the man. And I was so nervous, because once you get it all done, then you have to send everything in to an elected, one of the GWR officials. They have to go through everything, and they'll ask you questions and stuff like that to verify everything's good. And I was so scared that I wasn't going to get it. Then I was going to have to do the rest. Man, when that one came in, I was a happy camper to get that one.
But, donut stacking, that sounds like a Survivor challenge. You watch Survivor?
Yeah, right? I know. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the biggest takeaway from all this was, when the pandemic was happening, a lot of people allowed it to get them down. And I didn't want to, and I, you know, wanted to do something more. And I've always kind of thought it would be cool to, you know, I have a very competitive nature, if no one can tell. And it's, you know, it was just one of those cool things. And it was an eye-opening experience, and just a really cool thing. And since then, I've helped a few other individuals go after their Guinness World Records, and a couple of them have gotten them, actually. So it's one of those things I think a lot of people think is unattainable. Kind of like some of these hikes. A lot of people think I'm just too normal, I'm too average, I can't. Mm-hmm. No, anybody can do these hikes. Right. They can. They just have to have the right mindset. You can get up them. And I think that's kind of what I hope that I showed some people getting this Guinness World Records. It wasn't about their certificates. It wasn't about any of that. It was more about showing that attainability, that it is possible to get anything you want. Because, I mean, when you talk to I haven't talked to a lot of people that have a Guinness World Record. And before I got one, it kind of seems like one of those things that's unattainable, but it is. Anyone can do it.
You know, I was excited to have a world adventurer, professor, former military guest on the show, but I did not realize that I had the donut stacking world record holder in the studio. So, wow, what an episode. That's great. All right. Hey, let's go back to 2017. You talked about a little bit earlier before the break about taking this leap and going to Thailand. What led up to that? I know that you've been out of the military for a bit. And what led to that decision to say, you know what, did you sell everything? Did you get rid of everything? And you decide, I'm going to live a life of travel. This is the direction I want to go.
you know, I can't say that I had that type that I can't say I had that type of direction and I was that, you know, disciplined in essence, but it was kind of like, you know, I got a storage unit, put everything in the storage unit. I sold my car. I had a motorcycle, put it in the storage unit, everything. And it was more about, I was kind of, you know, when you live in the military and you're in the military for so long, you're taking orders, you understand structure and you understand, you know, this works this way. You do this, you do that, you do this, you do that. And then, you know, everything goes well. But when, you know, it was taken away from me so fast after getting hurt and stuff like that. I got a little lost. I was confused and I didn't really know exactly where I was at. And I just felt like I had no direction. And I think it was just one day, I saw like this clip on a commercial talking about come to Bangkok where dreams come true. And as funny as it is, it just stuck with me. It just stuck with me. So I spent about a month, you know, creating an Instagram handle and, you know, getting a few pictures because Instagram was, you know, it was obviously around well before 2017, but it was just getting pretty dang big. And, you know, I made a YouTube channel and I got all saying, and of course I thought, you know what? Everyone's going to want to follow me. Why wouldn't they want to follow me? Well, you learn really fast that it is a lot harder than that to get the followers and get people to think you have to find unique ways to do things. And, yeah, so I put everything in and went for it. And, you know, didn't really have much to fall on. But the one thing I really did, I think really helped me is at that time. So I got 15, 17. So at that time, that moment, I was finishing my MBA and I'd already done the first year, like in classrooms and stuff like that. And the second year, you know, was mostly a lot of the writing stuff. So we were able to do it remotely. So I think having that connection with like other students and stuff, even though none of them knew what I was doing, you know, you had your discussion boards and stuff like that. I think that kind of kept me kind of grounded and able to travel and just go on this crazy experience and go for it and still kind of have some of that, you know, structure in a lot of ways. I don't know if a lot of people understand what I'm saying there, but I think some people might. And it's just kind of like, I was like, let's just go for it and see what happens. And, you know, I started working at a hostel was the first thing because I quickly realized, you know, $1,000 wasn't going to go very far. So I started slowly and started figuring out how to cut out certain expenses. So first I went with hostel. And if you work at a hostel and a lot of different websites, you can find jobs with them. And they take people of all ages. I've seen there's 50, 60 year olds working there. There's 18, 19 year olds working there. And they'll pay for your accommodations and give you food. So right there, I just knocked out two of the largest expenses. Nice. Right off the bat.
Nice. And now in the 5 years since, you've been to more than 140 countries?
I believe 141.
141.
Yeah.
Can you give me a quick top five? What are your top five places that you visited?
Oof, that is tough, you know, because that's the number one question I get.
Yeah,
probably
right?
Number one.
You knew it was coming.
It's so hard because every country has so many great things. But I would say Bosnia was amazing. I would say Guatemala's up there. Argentina is up there. Thailand, still one of the top ones. And then Japan if I could live anywhere and money was no option, it would probably be Japan. The culture, the people, they're so welcoming. They're so nice. And there's just so much outdoors in Japan to do. The only problem is Thailand is very similar in a lot of ways, but about a quarter of the price. So it kind of makes Thailand even more, more interesting. But yeah, you know, when it comes to hiking though, Guatemala is that top list. It's just the hikes in Guatemala are just quite amazing.
Like Acatenango?
Acatenango, Pacaya. Yeah,
I just wanted to say it. It was awesome.
Yeah, I've noticed you like that word. You like that word a lot. I like it.
Now, Biggers, there's a group of people out there that their quest, their mission is to visit every recognized country out there. And I think there's 198 of them. If I may be wrong on that, but I think it's in that neighborhood.
Is that a
goal of yours to get to every single country?
You know, when it started, it was kind of one of those big goals. I know when I started, I know Drew Binsky, He's a huge YouTuber and stuff like that. And he was on his mission to go after it. And I was like, yeah, you know, that's kind of, but you know, honestly, as I've done it, I've learned that, you know, if it happens, it happens, but it's not a main goal anymore. Cause it's really, everything's kind of transitioned in a lot of ways. And I've learned that, like, I kind of prefer, you know, teaching people how to go after what, you know, what their dreams are. And, you know, it was in the beginning, it was all about accomplishing a task, but no, not now, you know, and I think I'll get really close, but there are some countries that are very, very difficult to get into, especially having a military background. And sometimes, like when I went to Russia the first time, I was in the interrogation room for a while. It took almost an hour to get in. I did get in, and they were nice. Everything was fine once I was in and stuff like that. And who knows why I was flagged going in. It could have been, you know, I just got done with Turkey or Saudi, right? You know, there's certain countries that if you have that country's seal on your passport, they won't let you into the next one. So it is it's definitely a tough process for sure.
Yeah, and there are also some unrecognized countries out there that claim to exist. They're not recognized. They have their own borders. They have their own monetary system. One of the most creative and interesting ones that I found from a former guest on the podcast is this country called Sealand. Have you heard of Sealand?
I know I've heard of it before. Where is it located at?
So in World War II, you had these anti-aircraft platforms in the North Sea off the coast of England.
Okay.
About 40 miles off the coast. And then, you know, when the war was over, these kind of were abandoned. And so this family moved onto one of these platforms and claimed it as their own and claimed their own sovereignty and named it Sealand. There's only been about three or four people living on it at any one time. And to actually get up to the platform, you have to sit in a sling and be winched up. So
sounds amazing.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. Sealand, look it up if you have a chance.
Yeah, for sure.
And then there's also a group of travelers out there that are really interested in dark tourism. Have you heard about that? Dark tourism?
No.
Where they go to like places that have experienced, you know, horrible things. It's kind of a weird twist on it. Like people going to the Chernobyl exclusion zone, which would be very difficult at the current moment with everything going on in that area. But the concentration camps in Germany and Poland, other types of just, you know, dark areas, places with a dark history, I guess, would probably be the best way to describe it.
I mean, travelers are when you look at the thing, we're talking about the rating systems with hikers. Travelers are the same way. Everyone has their reason for doing something. And I think it's the one thing that I think traveling abroad has taught me the most is, you know, no judgment. People do their things for the reason they want them to. And it's not my responsibility to show them how to do it my way. It's the individual's responsibility to find their own way. So if they enjoy doing things like that, that's all on them. Me personally, I love cuddly animals and I love going to places and doing the animals, but I can definitely understand that, you know, that dark tourism thing could be very enlightening and very humbling in a lot of manners as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about what you have developed as a result of your world travels, your social media, your website. I love the title of your website, tiredofworking.com. Take us through a little bit. If someone were to go on there, what would they find?
Well, they'd find adventures of me all over the world. And, you know, I have lots of articles on there showing, you know, how to start becoming a blogger, how to do this, how to do that. And I have a few, you know, there's hundreds of blogs on throughout my website and hundreds of different articles I've written. And, you know, the biggest thing is someone can read as many times as they want, you know, how to do something, but it's on the person. The person has to take that first step. They got to take that step. And that's what I hope when someone goes to my website, they see the adventures, they see me hanging out with elephants and, you know, koalas and sloths and stuff. And they're like, you know what? That's what I needed to see. That's what I needed to see to get me off this couch and just taking that one-way ticket. And hopefully that's what they get from it.
That's right. And I like something you said right there, or maybe a little bit earlier, that this may not be for everybody. I mean, your style of traveling may not be for everybody, but I would pose that, you know, a lot of what we talk about on this podcast is not for everybody. Long distance through hiking, not for everybody. Big wall climbing, not for everybody.
That is so true, because it is definitely not. Some of that long distance hiking, oh my.
Yeah, mountaineering, getting to the top of Mount Everest, not for everybody. But you know what? The adventure tree is a large tree with lots of branches. And if something hits your fancy and interests you from listening to this or listening to or visiting Bigger's website or social media, then there you go. I mean, we're just looking for things out there that really interest us and speak to us.
Absolutely, 100%. And I think that's the most important thing, is just finding your reason and going for it, no matter your age, no matter. And that's the thing too. While I've been traveling abroad, you know, I've met people as young as, you know, 17 and finishing high school and, you know, starting their travels around the world. And then I met people as old as 92 was my oldest one I met. And they were staying at a hostel in Poland. And it was amazing. Like the fact that a 92-year-old can be hanging out with a 17-year-old and talking about world travels, what's better than that?
Now, you said you had five books. You've written five books. What's the subject matter of your books?
All on traveling, pretty much. Okay. So two of them go into traveling, you know, how to go about beginning your travels. And then I have one that I wrote with a female author, and we wrote a book about talking about dating abroad in different countries and kind of how, you know, men look at some things one way and women look at some things another way, and the cultural differences and stuff like that. Like if you throw an English speaking male into a room with a Japanese speaking female, there's some cultural differences there. Mm-hmm. And it was more of just a book I want after dating, you know, people around the world. It was just kind of something that I thought people would be interested in reading with, you know, just different stories on how that some of those things work.
Okay. Now let's head to Guatemala and visit that place that we all love saying, Acatenango. Tell us about your experiences there and your adventures.
Well, like I mentioned earlier, Guatemala is one of my top fives. It's an amazing place. And when you get there, everyone goes to the same place. You know, you definitely, when you get into Antigua and then you go from Guatemala City up there, and it's a very welcoming city. English is spoke pretty, there's definitely some English speaking there. And more or less the people just, you know, they don't look down upon you if you don't know Spanish yet. And there's a lot of different Spanish schools that'll teach you. And Acatenango is probably a top tourist attraction there. And there's three of them. There's Pacaya, Acatenango, and Fuego. And they go up in that order. Pacaya is, you know, a 4-kilometer hike. It's not that long. And you get to, and you can see lava just flowing down. You can roast a marshmallow on the lava. We've done that before. Like you can roast it and eat it right there. It's very cool. But it's not an incredible hard hike. It's a very simple hike. And then once you do Pacaya, you go to Acatenango. Acatenango is I'd say it's a medium hike. It's not super difficult, but it's not super easy either. It's in the middle, and it's about 5 to 6 hours generally. So probably close to 10 to 12 miles or so. And you hike from the bottom and you hike up the top, and a lot of different like services will do it with you there. And you know, the hike starts off very, very open and green and pretty. And you're like, yay, oh my. And then it just goes to this area where it's just rock formations going up the mountain at like a 70 degree angle. And you're just like, this is the worst thing ever. And it gets, you know, it does get a little better and easier after that. But I did it in 2017. And then I did it again last year. And, So the hike is difficult, or is, you know, mediocrely difficult, but it's not like super hard. But then anyone who's feeling it can go for the double whammy. And the double whammy is Fuego. And what happens is when you get to the top of Acatenango, which, you know, now you've been hiking from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And 5 hours is going pretty quick. But so you get up there and now you're up on top of a volcano. You can look across the Fuego and see the lava erupting, and it's just amazing. But now you have a choice. And this is where the choices get interesting. So when you get up to the top, they're like, all right, guys, So you have two choices. You can sit here, you can eat, you can roast marshmallows, you can drink wine, and you can enjoy the set, the sunset, and just enjoy yourself. Or you can go on another 8 to 10 hour hike, back down Ocotenango, then up Fuego, then back down Fuego, and back up Ocotenango, and we'll have you here by midnight. Well, the competitive nature was like, you know what? I'm in. And I was expecting people behind me to also say they were in. They were not. So it was only me. So me and a younger Guatemalan man who can hike circles around me, does not speak a word of English, nothing. And my Spanish in 2017 was mediocre at best. I'm proud to say it's much better now, but it was not that good. Well, I'm like, all right, you know, I think it's, we ended up getting stuck when we went up. So I think something happened and someone had to leave the hike early. So we didn't end up getting up there till about 4 p.m., which is a little late to start Fuego. Well, we go for it anyways. And, you know, some hikers will understand this, but I look at it as kind of like the saying of quicksand. Once one thing goes wrong, it just doesn't stop. It just does not stop. And there is nothing, there's almost nothing that is more demoralizing when you're hiking than when things start going wrong as you start going down. So me and this gentleman, we start hiking down Ocotenango. Going, and so I don't know if I'm one of the minorities here. I think I may be, but going down a mountain is much easier for me than going up a mountain. Way easier. And I know I've talked to some hikers, they're the complete opposite, and they'd rather go up than down hurts their knees a lot more. For me, right, going down is so, I can run down and it's so much easier. We start going down and I'm cruising, we get down that mountain probably an hour and a half. He's of course, you know, way in front of me, but I'm keeping up somewhere. I can at least see him. And he's, as we're going down, putting little markers around trees. I didn't understand why just yet. Because yet again, when I did it through with Tropicana Hostel, and they have their own base camp. And all these different hostels and hotels have their own base camp. However, from Tropicana Hostel going down, there is no trail. There isn't like a trail that's been done. We're going over rock faces. We're sliding down things. And as we're going down, I eventually figure out, on the miserable way back up, we'll get to in a second, that he was making sure we knew how to get back up. So he was cracking glow sticks, putting them up there. We get down to the bottom and I'm okay. I'm feeling decent. We've been hiking now for close to 7-8 hours straight. And now I got to go up Fuego. Fuego isn't, it's not quite as long as Ocotenango. So, you know, maybe 2 hours, you can go up the top if you can go. However, my legs and knees, they ain't feeling that good. So we start slowly going up. And as we're going up, the clouds are coming in. The sun is going down. And we have to get to the top at a certain time or I don't get any pictures or anything. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, it's about the memory. It's about, okay, I agree 99% of the time. But when you've been hiking for 10 hours, you want a picture at the top of that mountain. You want one, because the thing is, too, you don't stay up there. You can't stay at the top of the top of Fuego, because Fuego is erupting. So you can't stay up there. So we eventually get up there. I'm really worn out, and the sun caught us. So now it's dark. The clouds come in. Temperature drops. The hiking guide is now like, all right, let's try to wait this out, because it starts even sprinkling on us. So it got me and him, we get, you know, we start cuddling pretty much, you know, next to this rock, just hiding down, because the wind is coming across, you know, you're thousands and thousands of feet up. So it's like, it's coming in, it's freezing. I didn't bring gloves. I didn't bring anything, because we had just dropped all our stuff off at the base camp. And I didn't put it all together. So I had nothing on this hike. So we get to the top. I am miserable on any level. And it gets to the point where the clouds come in, I can't even see the eruption anymore because you're so close and you're so close to it. So you can hear it, but you can't see it because the clouds are in now. And it was just, oh, it was so, so miserable. So then he's like, want to go back down. And it's probably, you know, it's going on.
For those of you who missed it, who aren't watching on YouTube, Biggers did a little pointing action with his finger, like pointing down in the downward direction. Let's get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. we're using a lot of hand motions. And so I'm like, yeah, let's go. And now keep in mind, you've been hiking for, you know, 8 to 10 hours and you just missed out on the one thing you wanted to see. On this whole, the going up there, what is the point of going doing the double whammy if there's nothing at the end? But now I have to go back down Fuego and back up Ocotenango before midnight or one, because there's another hike you have to do in the morning. We'll get to that in a second. So now we're going down. I am miserable. I'm not gonna lie. I'm saying words that I am so miserable at this point. We get down to the bottom, take a quick break, and now we got to go back up Ocotenango. Now, the hike back up is not as long as the initial hike up, but it is steeper. And as we go up, we start noticing we see no glow sticks. Something happened, and the glow sticks are not, like, they're not still there. They've fallen. So we start, but this guide has definitely done this hundreds and hundreds of times. So we start finding our way up. We get a little lost. My knees are done. I'm done. We're 12, 14 hours in now. I'm done. And the guide is, you know, I'm 190 pounds, 6 foot tall. The guide is, you know, maybe half my size. I mean, the guy is not a big guy. And he's now having to, like, you know, put my weight on him a little bit to get me up this thing. While we were running down Ocotenango to get to Fuego originally, I, of course, twist a little bit of an ankle, you know, and it's like, but I should have stopped there and went back up. I should have. But we all hikers know that little, we got that angel and that devil on our shoulders sometimes. And sometimes the other one wins. And, I'm just like, I can do this. I got this. So now we're going back up. I'm hurt. I'm miserable. I'm tired. Eventually we get to the top and our guy is completely lost. So now he's yelling out signals, like words, trying to get the guys at the top to yell back. And eventually it happens. And we figure out where we're at. Another guy runs down, grabs me. Now I got two guides like slowly carrying me up a rock face that is super steep. And eventually I get back up to base camp. It's about 1 a.m. I'm miserable, beat up. I didn't see the sunset. I didn't get to roast a marshmallow. I didn't get to drink wine. I hadn't eaten yet. So, I mean, and the guides are phenomenal. They made me dinner right then. They made sure I was okay. And then in the morning, you got to get up to go see the sunset back on Ocotenango. That's a big part of the hike. Well, in 2017, Joshua did not wake up for that morning hike because I couldn't move. I was just done. You know, Fuego got me. And you know, some hikers, they'd be good to go. But I remember I'm that 4.5 hiker. So, you know, a 4.5 hiker's got to think about these things. And anyone who has done Ocotenango and Fuego in the same day knows how it's not an easy hike. So in 2017, I wake up at like, you know, 7 a.m. They're all back from the sunset. I saw nothing. It was a miserable, miserable experience.
You got so Fuego.
Go ahead.
I said you got Fuego'd.
Without a doubt. I got straight Fuego'd. And so fast forward a few years, and now it's 2021. I'm back over in Guatemala. The pandemic is slowly settling. I believe it was November of last year. And so then I get another opportunity to do Ocotenango again. And this
I thought you were going to say they offered you that choice, that decision of, you know, one of two options. And you said, you know what? I'm going to take the wine and the marshmallows this time.
So they do eventually. So we get to Ocotenango. Crazy enough, the same guide is there. And now
he had to be shaking his head when he saw you show up.
Without a doubt. It was hilarious. And I have pictures of us together 4 years apart. And now I can speak Spanish a lot better. So now we're having conversations and he's just like, man, I didn't know if you would live after that. Like the way he was talking, it was hilarious. And so we get up, we got the whole group and we get up to the top and now they're offering double whammy time. Now I've done this. So there are a few people that are thinking about doing it. And I sit down and I ask him, I'm like, guys, I want you to think about this. What is your real reason for wanting to go do it? And by the end of the conversation, they're like, all right, you know what? I'll stay here for this time because I'm coming back next year. So I can do it then if I want. We ended up all staying together. There's about 12 of us, had one of the most magical, amazing nights ever. It was phenomenal. The clouds ended up coming in anyway, so those guys would have got stuck. So it ended up working out for them. By the end, they were, as soon as we got off the mountain, they were ready to buy me a red stripe and just like, dude, thank you so much. And you know, it is a chance thing. And, you know, eventually I'm sure they'll go back and want to do Fuego, but we had an amazing experience. We all just sat around, hung out. There was three German guys with us. And we didn't realize why their backpack was so heavy because they didn't tell us. We get to the top. These three German guys have two huge bottles of vodka and a 24-pack of beer. And we're like, what just happened? Like, what? Only the German hikers would do. And these German hikers, I mean, they were running up the side of this mountain. These guys, they're 21, 22 years old, have more energy than anyone could even think about. And it was just an amazing experience. And then in the morning, I woke up. Went and saw the sunset. It was phenomenal. Everything was so much better the second time around.
You saw the sunset in the morning?
Or the sunrise. Yeah. No. Now I'm like mixing it all up.
Now, when three Germans pull out two huge bottles of vodka and a 24-pack of beer, you know what we call that? That's trail magic right there.
They made some trail magic for sure. And the crazy thing, I'm not even kidding you. They were probably up till 3 a.m. and we all got up at 5 a.m. to do this hike and they were all still in the front. It was just, you're just like, you don't mess with German hikers, man. German hikers know how to do it.
They do. All right. Hey, Biggers, what's next on your adventure list? What's the next big trip you're taking?
So I got two coming up, or two large ones. So I'm going back to Bermuda in August. So I'm pretty excited about that. I haven't been there in a few years and it'd be nice to just really sit down and relax a little bit. And then in the beginning of January, I have a huge one going over to China to celebrate the Chinese New Year's with them. And I'm super excited about that because I'm going to go to Mongolia, the Philippines, and a few other different places over there. But spending big holidays in other countries, you just learn a whole nother thing. Like this year, I was in Brazil for Carnival. And it kind of got canceled, but it kind of didn't. Like it was a little, because they're redoing it this month, technically. But I can tell you firsthand, it didn't slow us down in February celebrating Carnival in Brazil. And when you go to these places, you just, whew, it's just amazing experience because you see the true culture at its finest in a lot of them on, just really exploring how they celebrate these holidays. So I'm pretty excited about the Chinese one.
That sounds great. Hey, Biggers, you know where we are?
Probably at something where I have to talk about something that I believe in.
That's close.
The pro tip insight of the week.
We're at that time of the episode where you share your pro tip insight of the week. What bit of travel wisdom or trail wisdom can you share with our listeners to make their next travel experience even better?
I can give one of each. With trail wisdom, you do not forget your snacks. Just don't forget your snacks. And it's not just for nutrition. It's because sometimes, you're just sitting there and you're so miserable that a snack can make your whole mood better. So do not forget your snacks. I never forget my peanut M&Ms. And I don't eat candy. It's the only candy I eat. And I always have me a bag, huge bag of peanut M&Ms when I'm walking up any type of bike.
It's not really a candy. It's got some protein in there. So I think you're right on.
Some protein. And then when it comes to traveling, I would say the number one thing I would say, and this is more or less for American travelers because the rest of the world's kind of already figured it out. But with American travelers, hostels are amazing places to stay. Do not think that hostels are like the movie Hostel. that horror right? movie is not a representation of a hostel. Hostels are the easiest way to think about them is think about like a mini summer camp. You know, there are bunk beds, but there are also private rooms. You don't have to stay in a bunk bed. You know, one of my sponsors, hostelworld.com, it's a great app to use, and they give reviews just like Airbnb. So you can look up the reviews of other people when they were there. They give you age ranges as well. So you can see what a 40-year-old reviews this hostel. So depending on your age or whatnot, anyone can stay at hostels. They're amazing places. And I would say for anyone who hasn't stayed at one, it should be on your bucket list to stay at a hostel at least once.
Okay, fantastic. So there you have it. That's it. This episode is just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Biggers. Want to thank him for joining us this week. Dr. Biggers, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
You can be with me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all of those through Biggers World. That's Biggers World. And then also tiredofworking.com is one of my websites. And the other one is thetrustednomad.com. And the Trusted Nomad is more about, like, it gives you things to help you become a better blogger and gives you ways to actually start your blogging experience. And Tired of Working follows all my adventures.
Okay. Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We are on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. No TikTok account yet, Biggers?
I haven't went into the TikTok world just yet.
All right. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com.
The Adventure Media Recommendation.
Joshua, I'm also looking to you to share a recommendation for a book, a movie, a documentary, some kind of adventure media. And we're calling this our Adventure Media Recommendation. What do you have for us?
Ooh, trying to think. There's that new one. I need to watch it. It's on Netflix, about the World Peaks. Have you seen that one yet? It's like the 14 World Peaks or whatnot.
Is that with Nimsdai?
I believe so.
Yes.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Is it incredible? I've heard so many people review it, and I just haven't had the time to watch it, but I know that one's probably amazing. And so I'm not only giving a review to everyone else, I'm giving a review to myself to also watch this thing.
Nice. Okay.
What have we not asked you?
Oh, wow. Before we wrap things up, I've just got one more segment for you called What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About? What do we miss?
I feel like we've talked about my entire life already. I feel like we've been on this thing for like 4 years. No, I think you've asked me pretty much everything here. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I went from soldier to, you know, traveler to professor. And, you know, I hope I've given some people some inspiration into, you know, 9 to 5. I understand a 9 to 5 job is a necessary evil for many people. But if you are able to be able to do the remote thing or the 9 to 5 or get rid of the 9 to 5 thing, it could be an amazing experience for you just to go out and, you know, try to see if the nomadic life is for you.
Yeah, you went from soldier to traveler to professor to world record holder. Don't forget that.
Can't forget. I mean, when it comes to donuts, stacking them donuts, I'm good to go.
He knows his donut stacking. Okay. Hey, that's a wrap from the John Freaking Muir Studio. Any shout outs to friends and family, Biggers?
To everyone that follows me and you know, DMs me on all my social media platforms, just, hey, keep doing it. And keep going after your dreams and making them bigger and bigger.
Okay. Thank you for tuning in. And always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if you've been carried halfway up the mountain by your Guatemalan guides. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.